My name is, my name in religion is Ravindra Swarup Das, otherwise Bill Deadweiler, and I come from the Hare Krishna temple. It's up in Ashram, it's up in Mount Airy, West Allen's Lane. And so I was asked to come and talk about the kind of spiritual practices that we do, the path we follow, especially, what did we say it was? Mantra yoga. Right. We'll talk about mantra yoga. The particular tradition I follow comes from India. It's a pretty old one. And if, you know, there's this general amorphous stuff called Hinduism, and there really isn't any one thing that corresponds to Hinduism. It's really a family of related traditions. If you took all the Christian and all the Jewish and all the Islamic traditions and you put them in one package and gave them a common name, you'd have something like Hinduism. In fact, people do that sometimes. They call them the Abrahamic faiths or the people of the book or something like that. Common set of scriptures, what the Christians call the Old Testament, common set of cultural background, common set of holy figures and so on. So this is our nobody really can speak for Hinduism because it's just not one thing. But within that, there are various traditions, historical, spiritual traditions, and so I'm linked up with one of those called the Vaishnava tradition. And but everybody that goes by the name of Hindu, there's a set of sacred books they all adhere to called the Vedas. And the Vedas, again, we call them scriptures, but actually the word Veda means knowledge, and they're just considered to be books of knowledge. But there's a medical science. There's called the Ayurveda. There's medical science. There's the Dhanurveda, which is basically political science. So it covers many things that we wouldn't particularly regard as spiritual. But in the Vedas, it's all kind of connected together with the notion that the highest end of life is spiritual. That ultimately human life finds its fulfillment in the quest for transcendence or for self-realization or liberation, and everything that you do is ultimately supposed to lead you to that. It's recognized that different people are in different stages and different places, and so the Vedas are sometimes compared to a tree that gives you any fruit you want. But it's not just arbitrary. There's ultimately the thought that it leads to a particular thing. So in the Vedas, the quest for transcendence is embodied in various sorts of spiritual disciplines. And the word for that is yoga. Now people right now that have a sort of an image of somebody in leotards or short pants sitting in a cross-legged lotus position and doing breathing exercises, and that comes from the yoga, but the idea of yoga is much bigger and much, much broader idea. The word yoga comes from a Sanskrit root, yuj, and it's a cognate with the English word yoke. As when you yoke together two oxen. So it has the idea of linking and joining the individual with transcendence or with the supreme. And it also has the idea of discipline. So it is some discipline that connects or conjoins the individual person with the supreme. And there are different kinds of yoga. What you usually think of involving exercises and postures and breathing practices is called Ashtanga yoga. Ashtanga means it has eight parts to it, eight branches, eight. It's also called Raja Yoga, the Royal Yoga, and one variation of that is Hatha Yoga. This Ashtanga Yoga is the sort of classic, very old, traditional yoga. Naturally, over the course of time, different people have gotten it and taken it in different ways and different directions. But there are other kinds of yoga that are quite different. One's called Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, these also have subsidiary practices which are also called yoga, like Mantra Yoga, Buddhi Yoga, and so on. I don't think I can explain them all today in the amount of time we have. As I said, what the particular tradition I follow is called Bhakti Yoga. That means connecting with the Supreme by means of the principal means is love and devotion. Karma Yoga means acting in such a way that you are active in the world, but you learn how to be not attached to the results of the action. It's detached and disinterested action.
So what was the name of that type of yoga?
Karma. Okay. Karma means action, but Karma Yoga means now you act in such a way that you are not attached to the results or the fruits. Usually when we do something is because we want something, but in Karma Yoga you learn to say that actually the Bhagavad Gita says you have a right to your work, but you do not have a right to the results. The results come by other things. That's called Karma Yoga. There's Jnana Yoga, where by the attempt of mind and philosophical understanding to penetrate further and further into the nature of things until you finally come into contact with transcendence. This is a kind of a philosophical and speculative practice that's called Jnana Yoga. Now most of what I follow is the book of the Bhagavad Gita. Give me one of those over there, you can see. We have an edition of it in our group. It has sort of a flashy cover, but this is the Bhagavad Gita, which is a part of the Mahabharata. It actually has only 700 verses, but this has a commentary in it, so it's a little thicker. But this is the Bhagavad Gita, which is a kind of a survey of all the different yoga practices and spiritual practices in the Vedas, and with the idea of bringing them to some kind of unified conclusion. And this is spoken by Krishna to Arjuna on the Battle of Kurukshetra. What I want to talk about is what is the notion of this of a spiritual discipline? What's it supposed to do? The idea that all these transcendental paths or yogas have in common is the notion that the personality or the individuality, the self, is not really a material or a product of the material world. There's the idea that somehow there's two kinds of things that have come into contact. One are the material structures and the energies that we see about us, and the other are the selves, what people would sometimes call in the West is the soul. But the Sanskrit word is atma, and atma means self. And it's not even that I am a body and have a soul. The Vedic conception is I am a soul, because the word for soul is self, and I have a body. It's a kind of a different idea. And the self is a spiritual entity, and which has no birth and no death. The Vedas say in the Upanishads, the philosophical part of the Vedas, it says aham brahmasmi, that is to say I am Brahman or I am spirit. And then the corollary is that is I'm not matter, or to put it another way, I'm not this body. Just like a driver sits in a car, I'm sitting in the body. The Bhagavad Gita calls it a yantra, which means a device or a machine that's made of material nature, and I'm sort of sitting in it and driving around, or really being driven around. I'm not the driver. I have a chauffeur, but I'm really the passenger in this machine. And the self, that is to say the soul, has the qualities of spirit which are described as Sat, Chit, and Ananda. Sat means without beginning and end or end, eternal. Chit means of the nature of awareness or consciousness by which you come to know things. And Ananda means joy or bliss. Sat, Chit, Ananda. This is a famous triad. The same triad ends up in the West and the teachings of Plato as the good, the true, and the beautiful, as three aspects of transcendence. So these are three aspects of the characteristics of spirit that is eternal, full of knowledge, and full of bliss. It's not that you have to do anything to stay alive. We are eternal. It's not that you have to do anything to ultimately discover things. You're already full of knowledge. Neither do you have to strive to become find sources of happiness. It's already there. That's our nature. But according to the Vedas, we do not experience ourselves that way. Rather, we experience ourselves as quite limited. We don't have, we have a beginning and an end. You know, like in the biographical dictionary, there's a name and there's two parentheses. but beside the date, that's we're enclosed in time, it seems. We are born and we die. We're always, never quite know if we're doing the right thing because our knowledge is so limited and partial and flickering. We don't know what the Bush administration is up to and all these things like that. We're always puzzled as to what's going on. And we have our methods of exploring the world with material science, and they're always announcing what we just told you for the last 30 years is wrong. Now we know it's this, and it keeps going. So you never quite know. Our knowledge is limited. And of course, we discover in the world there's so much suffering and anxiety that we're undergoing all the time. And the Vedas say that actually this is kind of an illusion that's imposed upon us. Because we do not know who we are. We've identified ourselves with the material body, and because of that deep identification, ahankara, this false idea of ourselves, this suffering is imposed upon us. Everything that happens to the body, we think of as happening to ourselves. So the idea is the liberation of the self. From this delusion or of matter. And so that's the endeavor. Now, the principle, there are different ways of going about it, of trying to do this. What the Vedas teach, and actually I think you find this taught everywhere. I mean, you don't have to go to this particular book, a set of books, the Vedas, but it's there in the teachings of Christianity. It's there in Buddhism. It's there in Taoism, Confucianism. It's there in Islamic traditions. There's this kind of general agreement on certain principles of spiritual life, and that is that you find in these traditions, at least on at least what I would consider to be the highest level, the notion that that in order to attain a state of liberation, enlightenment, salvation, however you call it, that there's some kinds of process or discipline you have to go through, exercises. The Greek word ascesis, where we get our word asceticism, means exercise. That there's as an exercise you do this. In yoga itself, this Ashtanga yoga, the ultimate or the general principle of any yoga actually is that one concentrates the mind by controlling the senses. So there's this notion that one has to gain control of the senses, and what's even more difficult, the mind. Because it says in yoga, the mind is easy, it can be your worst enemy or your best friend. And if you have not conquered the mind, it's your worst enemy. But if you've actually conquered it, then it becomes your best friend. So there's this principle, and if I could put it in a very general way, we wonder nowadays. We look at the traditions and religions and moralities that have been handed down to us, and we see they're full of these rules and regulations and restrictions and thou shalt nots and so on. Many times we don't know why those thou shalt nots are there. We think that in the olden times there were these nasty old guys, these patriarchs or something, who didn't want people to have fun, who were envious of the younger generation and sort of promulgated these life-denying nasty rules and regulations. These nasty patriarchs, you know, look something like the Ayatollah Khomeini or somebody, you know. We think like that. But actually, there are actually, originally, when the purpose was known, they were part of a practice of spiritual discipline, or of what is called in the Vedic tradition, yoga. When you don't know what they're there for anymore, then you complain about them. As long ago as like William Blake, you know, he talks about being in a garden by a church, and on the church it said, "Thou shalt not." And then he says, and priests in black gowns were walking their rounds and binding with briars my joys and desires. Because one experiences these restrictions as just inhibiting and suppressive and oppressive and depressive. And and often imposed on people by force. Of course, the idea of asceticism or any discipline is that you have to accept them voluntarily. Anyway, the reason is like this. I think that a general law, or just like when I actually started getting myself involved in spiritual life, I was one of these people who was searching for the truth. And I began at a bad place for it. As an undergraduate, I was a philosophy major at the University of Pennsylvania, and where I thought to think to be looking for the truth was thought to be extremely naive and silly. I once, in an early class, somebody said, you know, what is philosophy? And I said, well, it's asking questions like, who am I, where have I come from, where am I going? And the teacher replied, oh, yeah, that question. Yeah, we have one person in this department who asks questions like that. I say, my name is Ken Young, I am coming from College Hall, and I am going to Bennett Hall. And he written my little thing on the board, you know, crossed it out. Broke the chalk. This is, you know, so, but anyway, I kept looking, and after everybody in the philosophy department at Penn was so anti-religion, I began to think, well, maybe there's something to religion. So then I went to Temple University, who just, and on those days, this is the late 60s, they just started a religion department, and they decided that it was going to be the faculty would not just be scholars but practitioners at the same time, so that Hinduism would be taught by Hindus and Buddhists by Buddhists and Islam by Muslims and so on, people who presumably were scholars but also practitioners, so that experiential element was there. And so I was really going to see what was going on. And so I after about 3 years, I had come to the conclusion that what I thought was, yeah, the kind of common thing at the what I seemed to me to be the highest level of most religious traditions was summarized by Buddha when he said that material life in this world is suffering. And I could see that. I seemed almost self-evident to me. I know some people never really occurs to them, but I didn't have any problem with that. He says the cause of the suffering are our attachments, our desires. And the cure is to become free from desires. This is the first of his four noble truths, become free from desires. Okay, I agreed with all that, but when I found I could actually try, when I tried to do a few simple things to become free from desires, it didn't work very well. You know? And then this is about 1969, I guess, and especially in 1969, everybody was going nuts. I still believe this is a general principle, and in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that those pleasures which arise from the contact between the senses and the objects are, in fact, the source of all suffering. He uses the same word Buddha used, dukkha, is the source of all suffering. So, here in the world, we bring our senses into contact with the objects, we experience pleasure, and we say, okay, this is the way to go. We just keep multiplying that effect, you know, and then we'll be happy. But he says, no, it's just the opposite, actually. Because the reason is that every time we try to gain pleasure in this way, we become more attached, and we identify ourselves more and more profoundly with the material body, and therefore, whatever happens to the body, we suffer. We experience it as happening to ourselves. And so there's two kinds of it. Turns out that there's a kind of a general law of spiritual life that here's two things. Let's imagine like a pan balance, you know, an old-fashioned scale. And let's say on this side we'll call this enlightenment or self-realization. And this side we'll call sense pleasure, sense gratification, right? The law is, which it seems nobody can change, is that if self-realization goes up, then sense gratification goes down, and that if sense gratification goes up, self-realization goes down. They're inversely proportional like that. Now that's a tough thing to deal with, and most conventional religion ends up, people are trying to figure out a way to do this, you know, that they'll both go up at the same time. And that's what happens. That's why over and over again, somebody comes and Jesus or Saint Francis, or they come and they kind of establish a standard of spiritual life. People become all enlivened and dedicated and saintly, and then gradually over the course of time, it, you know, kind of levels out again, and then someone comes again and starts it up. And this is in the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna also says, "I come again and again," because of this this factor. So anyway, that's kind of the general principles of spiritual life. So it becomes this question of, if you want to enter into transcendence or come close to God, you have to somehow or other also deal with the other side of it. And the yoga system, that the classical Ashtanga yoga system, there are eight stages, not exactly stages, but eight parts. And the first two are called yama and niyama, and then asana, which means the sitting postures, which people know about, pranayama, the breathing exercises. Yama and yama means the things you're not supposed to do. There's a kind of the preliminary requirements. Like the niyamas are ahimsa, not causing injury to other living beings. You have to be non-violent. This would also mean naturally being a vegetarian, things like that. That's ahimsa. Satya, not ever telling a falsehood, being truthful and straightforward, not only in your speech, but also even in your thoughts. Asteya, not stealing, no kleptocracy is allowed, kleptocrats. Brahmacharya, celibacy, aparigraha, freedom from greed, not accepting more than you need, necessary gifts. That's what the things you shouldn't do. And then the niyama are socha, cleanliness, external cleanliness, abhyantaraha, internal purification of the mind, not thinking of violent things and so on. Greedy. Then santosha means contentment, a peace, mental peace. Tapas, penance, swadhyaya, study of the Vedas, and Ishvara pranidhana, the contemplation, absorption in God. These are like the preliminary, the don'ts and the do's. Then asana. Usually people skip the asana. But this is actually when you practice this as a serious spiritual discipline, these are the first two things. Then the sitting postures, which is really what this the sitting postures, and then after you do the sitting postures, pranayama, this regulation of the ingoing and outgoing prana, the breath. What that really is supposed to do is to prepare your body for long-term meditation, so you can sit still for a very, very long period of time. Also, the asanas make you healthy, because when you're going to do this kind of yoga thing and pranayama, it's a kind of a physical discipline to create the conditions for extended meditation, so that things like bad health they distract you. So one of the side effects is you become very healthy, and then the pranayama, the control of the respiration. The idea of the pranayama ultimately is you slow down the metabolism of your body. And there are stories of people gradually decreasing their eating, and as then they're breathing. They breathe slower and slower and slower, so that again they're not disturbed by the fluctuations of, they don't have to eat very often. They say they can live on air, and so on. Pratyahara means that now basically from with the pranayama you shut down your senses. With the pratyahara, you withdraw your attention and your mind from contemplating your memories and your desires. So this is the withdrawal of the mind. Then dharana, concentration of the mind on one thing. Dhyana, that means really meditation, deepening concentration. And finally, samadhi, which is described as the seedless trance, where self-realization actually takes place. So what this is supposed to do is ultimately bring about the clarification and expansion of consciousness. I should mention that when we talk about the self, according to the Vedas, the symptom or the sign of the presence of the self is consciousness. This consciousness, our ability to be aware and to undergo experiences, to be a subject and not just an object, this consciousness is really due to the presence of the soul, and is not a product of the material energy. But right now our consciousness is like light going through colored glass. It's contaminated, and by these exercises the contaminating agents are removed. And then consciousness gradually expands and becomes pure. And consciousness in itself is delightful. And the more consciousness can expand, the more alive we are. And the unfortunate thing about the material world is the whole tendency is to gradually constrict our consciousness. So this reverses this. So that's just one of the basic. So when people actually do yoga as a full spiritual exercise, it's quite a heavy discipline. I mean, you really have to be dedicated to do this. You're going to go and sit in a mountain cave somewhere and not move for months or even years, because you're withdrawn into a state of samadhi. Now all this stuff looks like maybe it's suffering, this denial of the senses and everything like that, but actually the goal is happiness. The goal of all these people is real happiness. But it seems that when we attach our happiness to the course of things in the material world, it just increases our suffering. And when we see that happened, then when we become really disillusioned and disappointed, then people just become depressed and cynical and take to intoxication and things like that. But the idea of a spiritual, the spiritual, great spiritual teaching is saying is that there is actually, we are in contact with or can get in contact with a source of happiness or joy that's ever increasing and which does not depend upon the course of material nature. In the Bhagavad Gita, it's stated that when one attains this samadhi, the end of yoga, it says that when upon thinking this, one thinks there is no greater gain, and in this position, one is not disturbed even in the midst of greatest difficulty. So that's just the general principle. Now, when people have gone through this exploration of consciousness, tried to uncover the self, They encounter not just the self with a small s, but also a self with a large s. We can call it the super self. We are the Atma. But the yoga practice always ends with people that follow all the way out in the encounter with the Paramatma, or the super self, which is the self of all selves, and is the soul of the universe. And this super self is the personality of the absolute truth. This is also one aspect of yoga and of spiritual discipline, the discovery that I am I as a self am linked up to a very much larger self who is unlimited. And bhakti especially concentrates on establishing a relationship through devotion with the Supreme Self. And the technique of bhakti, and especially using mantra yoga, is that it is very, very difficult just to withdraw senses from the objects and to try to become detached from things in the material world simply by negation. And the technique of bhakti is that instead of trying to, as in Ashtanga yoga, shut down the senses, well, that's basically what it does, is try to shut them down. Instead of trying to shut them down, engage them, that we can use our mind and our senses and connect them with transcendence. And whenever there's there's the practice of bhakti, whether it's within the Hindu traditions or the Christian traditions, bhakti is like a spiritual a path that occurs all over the place. This is it always involves the engagement of the senses, and this is especially true with the mantra yoga. There is a mantra. The word mantra means a sound that can purify or deliver the mind, which is the goal of yoga. And that instead of just trying to empty out our consciousness of material things, instead if we connect our awareness with something spiritual, then automatically if you become engaged positively on a spiritual way, then the detachment from the material is natural and easy. So this is the principle of bhakti, to engage the senses in the service of the master of the senses, and of mantra yoga. When I was myself was trying to become free from desire, as Buddha said, and found I couldn't do it, that's when I, in 69, I walked into a center where some people came down from New York and were introducing the practice of chanting. I went to the center and listened to a lecture. And first of all, the person talked about following principles of renunciation. And although that was turning people off around me, I thought, wow, you know, somebody's telling the truth. He talked about not eating meat, fish, or eggs, not taking any intoxicants, not engaging in illicit sex, and so on. And he said that you have to give your senses, in order to withdraw your senses from material activities, you have to give your senses spiritual engagement. And that was really a new idea to me. And he said that this spiritual engagement of the senses actually begins with the tongue and with chanting. And that's the idea of mantra yoga. A mantra is a sound that the Vedas contained, and these sounds do not really originate from the material world. They're transcendental sound. Because the idea is that it says in the Vedas that just as by sound the whole world was created. The first thing that appears is sound. So also by sound one returns to transcendence. And so there is this thing called spiritual or transcendental sound, and these are conveyed in mantras. And that if one brings chants these mantras, you're actually in connection with transcendence or with God. You see, it's said that the condition of transcendence is that of non-duality. So, but the material world is a world of duality. So if I say water, 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 my thirst isn't quenched. But if I say a name of God that's actually a name of God, I say the name of Jesus, or the name of Krishna, the name of Allah, then actually God is present. God is present in His names because of non-duality. That means I'm in contact with transcendence. And because that is pure, I also become purified. That's a kind of theory. Well, anyway, I heard the guys talk about like this, and you never know about a theory, but a theory is a guide for action. So I said, okay, well, I'll go home and I'll start chanting, and I began chanting. One way we chant, I'll show you. We chant the mantra on beads, which I carry on the bag. These are beads for chanting. Like rosary beads and things like that. The same for chanting. So I got some beads and I sat down and did some meditation. The only reason I kept on going is it began to work. It was working. It worked very fast. So that's how you can understand that this is it's actually a technique. You actually come into contact. And it's a way of concentrating the mind by controlling the senses, but by engaging the senses. Because we chant, we can spend some time. We can do a little chanting. We have those sheets there. If you'd like to do it, here's a couple of mantras that I printed up, and I brought a. Put this stuff down. And just now there's two ways. We're going to do it in a group way, right? You see, so the first mantra on there is a very simple one. And it starts with the most famous mantra of them all, Om. This is called a Bija mantra. Bija means seed. Om is a seed mantra. In other words, it's the sound from which everything else, all the other sounds in the mantra are generated. There's Om, and so the first word is. I tell you what we'll do. What we'll do is we'll chant it, and I brought this little thing here that just this is to engage our senses, right? And when you have a little music, it engages the emotions a little bit too. And so what I'll do. The way we do it is responsively. Like I'll go through and I'll chant the mantra, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, and then it's your turn, you chant it back to me. And then I chant it, and you listen, and then you chant while I listen. So that way it's back and forth, hearing and chanting, hearing and chanting. So this way, The tongue is engaged, the ear is engaged, the mind is engaged. There's a little rhythm to this. This is a harmonium. It's what's in India they call it a harmonium.
Are you familiar with the Srutibaksh?
Huh?
Are you familiar with the thing called the, I think
it's a Srutibaksh? Srutibaksh, yeah.
It just plays one tone.
It plays one tone, yeah.
Yeah.
See, I can, this can play one tone too. Because it has a drone, that's called a drone. But sometimes of that. But this was actually, I think, introduced to India by Christian missionaries. And has been adapted by Indian bhajan singers and all that. So this is a simple little tune. Okay. So what I'll do is let's go through this mantra. I'll say each word, you say it after me. Okay, so we got the pronunciation down. You ready? Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Okay, so what it means is the Om is kind of untranslatable, but it says the whole mantra in a little nutshell, and then says, Vasudeva means one who is all pervading. Bhagavan means the Lord. I offer my respects to you. That's a simple. In one sense, it's like a prayer, but in the other sense, it's simultaneously like a prayer. It's a prayer that's answered at the same time, because if you're praying to become into contact with God, by the very act of praying, you are in contact. At least, and so now what we just try to do is we try to just focus our mind on the sound of the mantra.